Good afternoon from USC's Annenberg Media Center, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For Thursday, November 30th, 2017, I'm Nadia Caldwell. First, a news update with Tommy Durkin.
9 out of LA Weekly's 13 editors lost their jobs this week. That includes all top editors and all but one of the staff writers. The cuts come as a result of Seminole Media's acquisition of the publication and have left many unsure of what to expect moving forwards.
I mean, everything about this company and their intentions and their identity has been a mystery. I mean, it's not uncommon for new owners to come in and make some heads roll, but really they essentially got rid of 90% of the editorial staff, so I don't even know how they're going to get an issue out a week from now.
That was USC journalism professor Gabe Kahn. With the layoffs taking effect immediately and few details being released surrounding the sale, it remains a mystery as to what the organization's motives are. Similar cuts, however, have been seen across the industry.
ESPN is basically facing the fact that fewer people are buying cable, so they're having to kind of just trim their workforce in order to understand how they're going to reach people in the future.
Print journalism continues struggling to compete with online sources, so it seems more layoffs remain a possibility. SoCal Gas Company said today that a strong odor in the West LA area was due to an odorant spill, not a gas leak. Residents flooded authorities with reports of a strong gas odor last night just after 9. The calls prompted SoCal Gas to send crews to the intersection of Pico Boulevard and Overland Avenue.
It was intense. It made me feel a little lightheaded.
Then I saw it on the news, and I was a little concerned. Actually, I was wondering if they're going to evacuate us.
That was Destiny Orenda and Kia Booth. There were no evacuations, and SoCal Gas officials determined it was from an odorant spill at the Hillcrest Beverly Oil Core near the Rancho Park Golf Course. Odorant is a non-toxic and added to natural gas so leaks can be more easily detected. SoCal Gas said the spill has been cleaned up and that the smell would dissipate a few hours later. Def Jam Records founder Russell Simmons withdrew from his businesses today in the wake of another sexual assault accusation. Screenwriter Jenny Lumet told The Hollywood Reporter that he sexually assaulted her in 1991. Model Carrie Clausen Kalagi previously told that LA Times that Simmons assaulted her when she was 17 years old. Simmons released a statement saying he has been thoughtless and insensitive in some of his relationships. He also said he didn't want to be a distraction, and he is stepping aside to commit himself to his personal growth. Tonight, temperatures will drop to the low 50s with mild winds. Tomorrow will bring a high of 73 and sunny skies. As we enter the weekend, temperatures will remain in the mid-70s with the partially cloudy skies. Elon Musk's vision for personal rapid transport might be coming to Los Angeles if one city councilman gets his way. Paul Koretz wants to help the tech magnate develop his proposed network of underground traffic tunnels, even if that means funding the project entirely through private money. Koretz, who is also the vice chair of the Transportation Committee, wants to expedite the permits necessary for Musk to break ground on the project. It is still unclear exactly how Koretz will achieve this. Today is Maulid al-Nabawi, the holiday celebrating the birth of the Prophet Muhammad. It falls on the 12th day of the 5th month of the Islamic calendar. Brian Vogt Nilsson has more.
Some people celebrate the day by focusing on the life and teachings of the Prophet. He is often accustomed to sing and say prayers in remembrance of how he forgave even his most bitter enemies. The holiday first occurred in the 13th century, where it was celebrated much more heavily with huge gatherings of people in one place, special gift givings, and monstrous feasts. Although celebrations are much more subdued nowadays, in fact, the Prophet urged his followers not to make a big deal out of his birthday like Christians do for Jesus. So many Muslims today do not celebrate in respect of the Prophet's wishes. For Annenberg Media, I'm Brian Vogt Nilsson.
Is something really lost if you know where it is, but just can't get to it? That's what happened in the case of the missing backpack. Alexandria Mason has the story.
It's final season, which means there's only a stack of projects standing in between students and the freedom of winter break. But while out reporting on a project near Venice Fishing Pier, my classmate Kaylee Wells had a nightmare happen.
So we came back about 5 hours later to find that my passenger window had been shattered. And just about everything was taken inside. So that included the school's camera kit. That included a laptop.
Kaylee estimates it was over $2,000 worth of items stolen, including her wallet, which held her credit cards, birth certificate, and checkbook.
So really just about everything. They had two forms of identification for me. They spent about $1,000 on my credit cards.
But Kaylee has some anti-theft tech items that make her better off than most people in recovering her belongings. So much so, she's been doing her own investigating.
We're going to Basecamp Fitness because my Tile app told me that it was last seen about 2 hours ago just outside of this building.
Tile is a mobile app that uses Bluetooth tracker technology to locate lost items. Wells had a tracker on her backpack, and now we are playing detective in search of a ping and a dream in Santa Monica.
And I'm going to check my Tile app to see if I'm within 100 feet.
So if you were close to it right now, it'd be pinging.
Right. If I were within 100 feet of it right now, I'd be able to get it to ring back at me.
Tile's website says over 2 million lost items have been recovered using the app.
Has a black backpack been turned in?
But Kaylee's not one of those 2 million yet.
So this is what I did yesterday, too, is I would just go into garages and near trash cans and just find places where someone might dump a backpack.
So although the app is helpful in locating lost items, it isn't really effective if the tracker is still in motion.
So this is showing our location, and then right at this other location across the street is where it got pinged 2.5 hours ago.
So it could have been someone en route.
Yes, sometimes someone could be in their car driving 35 miles an hour and it'll still ping them.
The case of the missing backpack isn't yet a cold case, but without the help of police, apps like Tile, Find My iPhone, and other location trackers have their limits. And with petty theft being such a common occurrence in a city like LA, it's not necessarily at the top of police agendas. But if you're curious, Kaylee got an extension on her projects. For Annenberg Media, I'm Alexandria Mason.
It's 7 minutes after the hour. I'm Tommy Durkin.
Thanks, Tommy. Coming up on From Where We Are, how is President Emmanuel Macron faring on his trip to several African countries? We take a look. '17 has been a tumultuous year. Here in Los Angeles, we've gone from no professional football team to an abundance and a building boom. The 8th City Council District is also seeing big changes. Chantel Buchai sat down with District 8 Councilperson Marquise Harris-Dawson for a year-end review.
What would you say are your biggest accomplishments this year?
Well, you know, this year, our biggest accomplishment is confronting homelessness head on. We were able to entitle and get the process started on hundreds of units of homeless housing in the city of Los Angeles. We were able to implement Measure H, which meant we put about $300 million on the street for services for homeless people, everything from substance abuse treatment to job training to emergency housing to bathrooms, showers, all those sorts of things. In a couple of days, we'll open up a little village downtown that'll have bathrooms and showers and services for folks living on Skid Row. And so I think we're turning the corner on homelessness, which is the biggest accomplishment that I think we'll make. Also this year, I think we'll set cannabis policy for the city of Los Angeles. California's finally moving out of the dark ages, so we're no longer going to lock you up and put you in jail because you decide to put marijuana in your body. And so we're setting the rules for where the stores can be and where the production can be and what the testing and consumer protections will be for this new product that'll be on the market, as well as making sure we remove all the old vestiges of the war on drugs from our books.
Those are great accomplishments. What are your last items on your agenda for the last month of the year?
So the last month of the year, we've got to wrap up cannabis. We've also got something called a linkage fee that we hope to bring to a close. The linkage fee would be a fee on the luxury housing development that you see downtown and in Hollywood and different parts of the city. Well, that luxury housing, we believe, should be assessed in a way that there will be money for affordable housing, right? So if you want to build an apartment that costs $4,000 a month, fine, great. But you're going to set aside some money so that someone else can build an apartment that regular working people can afford. And so we hope to get the linkage fee passed by the end of the year as well.
And what are your main goals for 2018?
Well, 2018, you know, we got to continue our work on homelessness. It's a long way to go. So we got to stay focused on that. And also we want to focus on the district. It'll be the last year of the construction of the Crenshaw Line. The Crenshaw Line is set to open in 2019. We got to make sure Crenshaw Boulevard is ready to realize the promise that something like the rail brings and realize it in a way where the people who live here now get to benefit. And they don't get driven out of the community by higher rents and what we commonly refer to as gentrification. Also, we want to look at jobs. So we have big programs. So $13 billion to redo the airport. You know, we're building new terminals. If you've been to the airport lately, you know it's being totally redesigned. Hundreds, even thousands of jobs. We have Measure M rail lines being constructed all around the county. Those are thousands of jobs. You see stadiums going up. We've got two football stadiums, one for soccer, one for American football. Thousands of jobs. We've got to make sure those jobs focus on the neighborhoods and communities that have struggled with unemployment. And so we'll be putting a lot of energy into that next year as well.
Which leads me to my next question. In the Crenshaw area, other than like the jobs, what other ways would the community be benefiting and how have you been addressing their concerns?
Well, the community can benefit in a very, very tremendous way. First of all, the small businesses that have frankly not done as well as they could have, because our community has historically been cut off from the rest of the economy in Southern California. Now you'll have thousands and hundreds of thousands of people coming through the community. They can get off the train. They can stop. They can go to a restaurant. They can go to a coffee shop. They can go to a local art store. They can patronize the many great artists that are stationed in Leimert Park at this moment. Also, the community will get all new streets, all new sidewalks. We're planting 1,000 trees along the Crenshaw Corridors. And those are things for the people in the community now. We've also got to do some housing development, and we've got to do some affordable housing development. So we're going to do some for seniors. We're going to do some for young working families. We're going to do some for people who are formerly homeless all along that strip. And that will be a permanent place. That'll be covenanted housing. So that means for 55 years, it stays affordable. Those are the kinds of things that folks will benefit in the immediate as the train starts to roll.
Sounds like a very well-developed plan.
It's a good plan. Now we got to just go out and do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this interview with me.
Excellent. Thank you.
That was Marquise Harris-Dawson speaking with Chantel Buchai. DACA and healthcare. Two big stories in the news are more intertwined than you think. Immigrants covered under the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals are excluded from purchasing the more affordable health insurance plans on state and federal exchanges. Laura Buzzari looks into one man's struggle to provide health care for his daughter.
Martinez Alfaro is lead mechanic at a muffler shop in Orange County. He works hard, pays taxes, and will never see a Social Security check in his life. Alfaro is one of the 2 million people living in California illegally. His 4 children have DACA status. DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was put in place to protect those illegally brought to the U.S. from deportation. President Trump has rescinded the program, and it's left this population in limbo. Alfaro's kids renewed their DACA status. That means they can still go to college, work, and pay taxes for the next 2 years. But health insurance is another story. Alfaro does not get health insurance from his employer. His daughter, Lupita, was born with Goldenhar syndrome, a condition that affects her brain development.
Physically, she's growing up 100% good, but she's like my baby, 18 years old baby. We have to shower her, we have to feed it. She has the tube to feed her.
In California, DACA recipients can get insurance via Medi-Cal, but the coverage is often minimal.
To get the medicine for my daughter, it's not that easy.
The main medication Lupita takes is Lamida-Cal, a seizure medication that can retail around $500 for just a 90-day supply. Afaro goes to lengths to get the drug at a somewhat reasonable price.
I have to search one guy, and that guy have to search another guy, or sometimes I have to order it from on the internet, from Canada or from Mexico, because the insurance doesn't cover over here.
Now, through the state and federal exchanges, a 90-day supply of Lamictal can be bought for $150. Immigrants who are not here legally are not eligible to buy the somewhat affordable health insurance via state and federal exchanges, even though they work and pay taxes. Jean Reyes, a clinical teaching fellow at USC's law school, says the government does not consider DACA a pathway to citizenship.
All that DACA says is we're not actively seeking to deport you and you can work here legally.
California has the highest number of undocumented immigrants in the country. UCLA public health professor Stephen Wallace argues that barring immigrants without legal status from getting affordable health care is counterintuitive.
So the United States has built its economy over the last 30 years on a steady supply of cheap labor. The cheap labor doesn't come from domestic sources. It comes primarily from immigration.
Alfaro says the change in ideology has to be made with those at the top. He says President Trump's rhetoric on both immigration and health care is fear-mongering.
This is his kid. Everything will be different, totally.
There have been some efforts made by California House Assembly members to change the state's rules to include those who are not here legally, but they have failed to pass. For Annenberg Media, I'm Laura Buzzetti.
On this week's edition of International Current, we take a look at the relationship between the African and European unions.
French President Emmanuel Macron is trying to save the world, and he's starting with EU-African relations. But south of the Mediterranean Sea, he's finding that the implications from France's colonial past might precede his good faith, whether he likes it or not. Welcome to the International Current. Today, Emmanuel Macron's tour of Africa, what happened to Burkina Faso and Côte d'Ivoire, and what is the president of the French Republic trying to accomplish? I'm Ryan Thompson. Donald Trump is putting America first. Angela Merkel can't form a coalition to govern Germany. And Theresa May's Brexit talks are in shambles. In other words, there's an opening for leader of the free world. But newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron says he doesn't want the job. His recent actions, however, suggest otherwise. He's put himself in the global spotlight in recent months, including this week during a four-day tour of Francophone Africa, stopping in Burkina Faso, Côte d'Ivoire, and Ghana. Overall, he's tried to ease hostility for France and foster a better relationship between the EU and Africa. But the question remains, was he successful and what should we make of it? Joining me to discuss is Valérie Gasse, a correspondent covering Mr. Macron on Radio France International's political desk. Bonjour Valérie, merci de nous appeler.
Bonjour Ryan.
Before we begin, just a note to listeners, Valérie has asked to speak in French, so we'll be translating her interview. So, Valérie, explain to us what Emmanuel Macron has done during his tour of Africa. What's the goal of a trip like this?
Alors, ce qu'il a tenté de faire et ce qu'il a dit dans son premier discours...
What he tried to do and say during his first speech in the capital of Burkina Faso, Ouagadougou, was to show that there was a new stage in the relations between France and Africa. France is an ex-colonial power, and people often speak about la France-Afrique, a particular relationship where France is dominant in relation to Africa. All French presidents have tried to change this during their eras, but he said it in a different manner, by saying that they were a new generation, that the Africans were young, and that he was young. He said that they would turn the page of colonization, and how France will be there to accompany Africa, but not in a position of domination. I think this was one of his main messages during this trip.
And you're not alone in that assessment. Listening to pundits in French media, particularly in newspapers and on the radio, there's been a lot of talk about the discourse at the University of Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso and fixing the image of France. But France certainly has anything but a clean colonial past. So how are the implications of colonialism affecting his trip?
Alors, il y a ce discours à Ouagadougou. Bon, il y a eu d'abord un discours et puis ensuite, il y a eu un échange avec des jeunes.
In Ouagadougou, after his speech, he exchanged with the youth and spoke in a very relatable manner. He spoke in quite a laid-back and relaxed fashion. He attempted some humor, which in relation to the President Kabore of Burkina Faso was considered slightly out of line. This was criticized as being too laid-back and him not taking into account that he was addressing an African head of state. This humor that he tried to have with the students was considered slightly inappropriate. Certain people associated it with a slightly colonial discourse. But I think he just wanted to show that he was in a direct relationship with the youth and took the risk of stepping on a thin line.
Sur la ligne rouge et a prêté le front à certaines critiques.
And finally, there was a big announcement at the African Union summit a day later, joint action between the EU and the African Union on a migration task force. How did Macron bring these parties together for one of the most productive dialogues we've seen on migration in a while?
Oui, alors ça c'est une des choses concrètes très importantes qui ont.
This is one of the most concrete and important things that happened. We all saw around the world, in France, in Africa, and of course in the United States, the images on CNN showing slavery to which certain migrants are victims of in Libya. These images provoked many reactions, and notably from the French President Emmanuel Macron. At the summit between the African Union and the European Union in Abidjan, it was decided to install a police/military presence to end the situation where networks exploit people, ultimately reducing migrants into slaves. Emmanuel Macron, the African Union, and the European Union decided to cooperate and committed to installing a concrete action force on the ground in the upcoming weeks to end this situation, which has shocked many people. This is one of the most tangible results, but of course we will have to see what actually happens, if it really happens, if it is efficient, but it is one of the strongest commitments from this summit in Abidjan.
Valérie Gasse from RFI, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ryan.
The French president returned to mainland France just a couple of hours ago. It now falls to him to put this discourse and diplomacy into action. For Annenberg Media, I'm Ryan Thompson.
You may have more in common with legendary actor John Wayne than you think. Find out how in this week's Trojan Tales.
Well, forget the apples. Slap some bacon on a biscuit and let's go. We're burning daylight.
He's an American icon, a symbol of the Old West. By the time he was burning daylight, the entire world knew him by the name John Wayne.
You think, oh, everyone knows John Wayne because he was like the number one box office actor for, you know, many years and that kind of thing.
That's Sandra Garcia Myers. She's an archivist at the Cinematic Arts Library.
A lot of young people don't know who he is.
John Wayne was one of the most popular film actors of the 20th century. He starred in more than 140 films over his 50-year acting career and won an Oscar for his legendary role in the 1969 film True Grit.
The winner is John Wayne.
What many people don't know is that John Wayne was once a student at USC. Back then, he was known as Marion Morrison. Like many Southern Californians, John Wayne spent a good deal of his time at the ocean. While out body surfing with a friend, just before his junior year, he injured his shoulder and could no longer play football. Duke quit school and began working for Fox Studios. From there, he rode his high horse to superstardom.
Part of the reason that USC students should care about John Wayne is that that kind of magical mix of physical presence that this university is still fascinated by, intimacy with the entertainment industry, and an aspiration to a kind of world-shaping, culture-molding effect.
That's J.D. Connor, associate professor at USC Cinema School. If you want to pay homage to John Wayne here on campus, you can check out the Wayne Family Lounge. It's on the second floor of the George Lucas Building of the School of Cinematic Arts. You can see posters, props, and other memorabilia from his life and career. For Annenberg Media, I'm Adam Askenizer.
If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Brian Vogt-Nielsen with today's Root Source.
Located in about 50 city blocks of downtown Los Angeles, an estimated 8 to 11,000 people live in a place known as Skid Row. The phrase Skid Row refers to a poor area in a city that is inhabited by the impoverished. The expression originated during the Great Depression. A resident of Skid Row was defined as someone who was slipping down in society or who was on the skids. Although these skids weren't just figurative, in the late 19th century, there was an expansion of the logging industry in the United States, where millions of trees were chopped to supply the building trade. These large tree trunks were hauled on tracks made of greased timbers, and the loggers referred to them as skid roads. We can't be sure how the forest tracks became associated with its current definition, but according to phrase.org, it's speculated that due to the unreliability of employment in the timber trade, loggers hung around the skid roads hoping for work, thus linking the tracks to the bottom of society. However, the alteration from Skid Road to Skid Row was established by the 1930s. For Annenberg Media, I'm Brian Vogt Nelson.
In today's edition of Hear from Heritage, we caught up with USC Volleyball's Kalia Lanier.
Women's volleyball begins postseason play Friday against Central Arkansas. Sophomore Kalia Lanier earned all-conference recognition after leading the Trojans to a 22-9 mark.
It's nice when you get recognized and you get awards, but I couldn't do anything or get any awards without my team, so it's not necessarily an individual award, but every single thing that I get or I get recognized for, it's because of my team.
Lanier is especially grateful for the leadership of this year's seniors.
All the seniors kind of bring their own different thing to the table, so I just kind of have to pick and choose what I learn from them and the things that they're teaching me and take it for granted while I still have this time with them.
After a strong regular season, the Trojans feel ready to face tougher opponents.
At this point, when it's so far and like late in the season, there's not much we can do to get better necessarily, but we just kind of have to maintain the high level that we're at. So just kind of getting a lot of reps in the gym and really working hard and working on our chemistry and just cleaning up our game and not trying to make as many errors, but just going for it.
Lanier believes last year's early exit from the tournament will help this year's team stay focused in the postseason.
I think from the last Hawaii game, losing 15-13 in the fifth, we all just kind of learned never to take anything for granted. We had a really short tournament experience, so I haven't really gotten the full experience of the postseason in the NCAA tournament. So I think just going all for it and not trying to take anyone for granted or looking over any teams and taking it game by game is the most important thing for us.
First serve against Central Arkansas is at 7 p.m. on Friday. With Annenberg Media, I'm Stuart Gill.
With one day left in the semester and one month left in 2017, USC students have a lot to say.
This semester is almost over and 2017 is coming to a close. So we decided to go around campus and ask students to describe their 2017 in one phrase. And our fellow Trojans had a lot to say.
Busy, fun, hectic, packed, and busy again. Does that count?
Tumultuous.
Yeah. Like a hurricane? But like right before a hurricane.
Upsetting, selfish order.
Traveling around the world.
Competitive and rewarding.
Respecting closed doors and looking for windows.
New journey.
Sleep deprived.
For many, looking back on the year is overwhelming, but undergraduate student Eloisa Campesano had a more humorous approach to handling her 2017.
My mom says this, but it's me siento pero soy chingona. So it's, you know, it's been rough, but I still got it.
So if there's anything you can take from 2017, just remember, no matter what, you still got it. For Annenberg Media, I'm Maya Tejas.
That's it from where we are. This is our last show of the semester. It's been a joy bringing you the news every Thursday.
We want to thank all of the journalists that have contributed to the show. A quick shout out to a few of our semester regulars, Devon McRae, Maya Tejas, Ava Macha, Ryan Thompson, and Aziza Kasimov.
We'd also like to thank Sebastian Gruba and Victor Figueroa for all their help this semester, our board operator Chris Perfett, our producer Norhan Matmoon, and of course our faculty advisor, Willa Seidenberg.
They put in hours of hard work each week, and we are beyond grateful for all they do. I'm Tommy Durkin.
And I'm Nadia Caldwell.